Oh, you're very quiet there.
Okay, just a quick question. This is not a subject I know a lot about, but in your opening remarks, you were referring to fascist theorists of law, you know, given some historical background. And I was just curious if you've done any research or if you had any comments on the flip side of the coin from the 30s, the Soviet legal scholars, legal theorists in the 30s, because I kind of vaguely remember that there was the Soviet constitution of 1936-37 was at the time considered the most just and most legal system as was in the world. And I was just curious, I'm just curious, as a form of background, if you'd looked into that, you know, as a contrast to what, you know, fascist scholars or any other sort of scholars were talking about in terms of law and class society during that period.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I mean, the Stalin Constitution, it was...
Repeat the question? Because I couldn't hear what you said.
Sorry, yes. So the question was, at the beginning, I mentioned having looked at some fascist thinkers in studying this theory. The question was, have you also looked at any Soviet thinkers who were sort of the polar opposite of that, in a sense, to fascism in the 1930s? And specifically, the person asking the question made mention of the 1936 Soviet Constitution and asked if I looked into that at all. The 1936 Soviet Constitution, otherwise known as the Stalin Constitution in the USSR, was on paper one of the best in the world. Not only did it guarantee freedom of expression, political democracy, the right to privacy, and all these other fantastic things, it also gave people the right to healthcare, the right to work, the right to housing, the right to holidays, many, many other very, very progressive things. Now, as we all know, the fact that they included this in their constitution did not mean that the USSR had freedom of speech, did not mean that it had privacy, didn't mean that it had holiday pay and so on. In reality, the Soviet Union was a dictatorship, a very authoritarian state. And indeed, as I think as Liam draws attention to, this is a perfect example of what we talk about when we talk about the material constitution. That on the one hand, you have this fantastic forward-thinking document that promises a very egalitarian, democratic, just society. And then at the same time, the Soviet government was going about creating a police state. Police state under a very, very strict regime of capitalist development. You had at the same time as the Stalin Constitution was written, projects with things like electrification and industrialization that required enormous amounts of central planning to bring them to fruition, and a huge amount of exploitation for ordinary workers. In terms of Soviet legal thinkers and what they said about it at the time, I'm not familiar with those who wrote during the Stalin era in particular, but I am familiar with a Soviet judge and jurist by the name of Evgeny Pashukhanis, who rose to prominence in the early 1920s, briefly became one of the most prominent judges in Soviet Russia, and then was unfortunately executed by Joseph Stalin for being broadly anti-authoritarian. His name is Evgeny Pashukhanis. In 1924, he published a book called The General Theory of Law and Marxism, where he makes an analysis of law that is very, very similar to what a lot of these scholars of the material constitution are saying. I don't have a copy on hand, and I can't quite remember what the argument he makes is, But broadly, he's similar to many other Marxist scholars who've studied law and constitutions. He points out that that rights in a capitalist society are elusive, that essentially the crucial factor, the dominating factor in social relations is the economic one and the inequalities of wealth and so on. I feel like I'm not doing him justice, but certainly there were Soviet thinkers in the early days who were aware of these problems and or these incongruities between capitalist freedom and the realities of a capitalist economy. However, after Stalinism took root in the Soviet Union, anybody who did subscribe to these ideas was censured. The Soviet state was very keen on centralization and using the law as a tool of repression. And so any views which sort of criticized the legal apparatus were strictly censored. And were only, Pashkanis's ideas were only really discovered in the West in the 1970s and in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. I hope that sort of answers your question in a slightly roundabout way.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you.
Anybody else? Can't see anyone. Okay. Well, go ahead.
Oh, we've got Dougie. Go on.
Oh, I think you muted there.
I'm just managing to unmute. Yeah, it's interesting talk about the material conception. I mean, you get these governments, maybe in France, Mitterrand and Hollande, who get in and they say they're going to tax the rich, and then the rich just move their money out of the country, really, you know. And that's going to be a problem of a lot of left-wing sort of governments, really, you know. They may think they can do something about inequality, but when they try to do it, they have the same problem as Truss or whatever, you know, had in a kind of opposite direction. They're not allowed to by the capitalists, really, you know, who own all the wealth, right? Really, you know. So I think your talk was interesting, right? Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks very much. And no, you're absolutely right. And somebody like Mitterrand is a perfect example of this. Allende, you know. But it's not just a modern thing either. You know, you can go back and look at Ramsay MacDonald's Labour government in the 1920s. Came in promising all these social reforms. Suddenly you have the Great Depression, and within a few years they're cutting unemployment benefits. The Popular Front in France, elected in, I think, 1936, I think it was, again, promising all these social reforms, suddenly doing an about-face and going back on their word for the sake of peace and stability and social order. So, that is really the heart of, certainly for the Marxists and socialists, I'll come to you, Paddy, in one second, certainly for the Marxists and socialists who've written about the idea of the material constitution, that sort of question of what are the realistic, or not what are the realistic limitations, but what are the economic limitations on what left-wing governments can achieve is a crucial part of the equation. Paddy, I think you have a hand up. No? Okay.
I'd muted myself again.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, elementary error. Yeah, well, I'll speak because nobody else is proposing to. I thought it was interesting what you were saying about this theory of the material constitution, which I suppose you could sort of equally call a materialist conception of law, versus this idea of autonomous law. I think you described it as, was it self-reproducing closed system, something of that sort? I wondered, well, who actually believes in this concept of autonomous law outside certain legal academics? Because you're not going to find any socialists who buy into this. And in fact, I would guess you won't find many workers who would buy into it. Most workers who aren't completely sort of zombified by celeb news and reality TV have got a pretty sort of, I would say, down-to-earth conception of what law actually is. And, you know, if you say to most people, well, you know, there's a big difference between what law says and what it actually does, they'll go, oh, yeah, really? Duh. You know. Having said that, I've noticed in recent years a bit of a trend amongst workers fighting for, you know, better paying conditions to take their fight through the courts rather than through unions as they once would have done. There may be various reasons for this, not least the fact that unions are not as strong nowadays as they used to be because of fragmented working, because of zero-hour contracts, and, you know, lots of reasons. And I thought, well, I suppose you could extrapolate a future trajectory from that towards one where you suddenly got a bunch of people arguing for a legal route to socialism. You know, otherwise we can get socialism by fighting through legal means, through the courts. I mean, I don't really think that would ever happen in a million years, but, you know, I suppose I'm just... This is almost sort of reductio ad absurdum that I'm offering here, just to sort of underline the question, who actually believes in this notion of autonomous law that floats, you know, that floats above the rest of human society in this sort of bubble of its own? I couldn't help remembering that, that's that famous quote, you'll know, of Anatole France, the one about... In its majestic equality, the law forbids rich and poor alike to sleep under the bridges, beg in the streets, and steal loaves of bread. I mean, the reason that that's so famous is because everybody knows that law isn't autonomous at all. So, yeah, I'd be interested in your comments about the sort of down-in-the-street view of the material conception of law versus autonomous law.
Yeah, thanks for that. There's a number of really, really fascinating points there. I think this idea of autonomous law as being separate from sort of other social factors is accepted implicitly and unquestioningly by most lawyers and legal academics. And of course, I studied law. I've been studying law in total for 4 years now. And at one point, I accepted that view as well, not because anybody put the view to me and said, here, think about this, but just because of the way studying law works, the way you learn law at universities, you're sort of taught implicitly to see law as this kind of big, grand system of principles that stands above ordinary politics. You know, politics is dirty and based on compromise, whereas law is pure principles and, you know, stands above the sort of trash of everyday politics. This is how I would say probably most lawyers think. But of course, yeah, I don't think there are many people out there, you know, the man on the Clapham Omnibus who would actually subscribe to that view. I think a lot of lawyers would accept that law is impacted by everyday phenomena like economics and, you know, political jockeying and so on. But what their response to that would be is sort of like, well, yes, but the thing which makes law autonomous is the fact that it doesn't have to be, say, inherently supporting one value over another. So because hypothetically you could pass a socialist law instead of a capitalist one, for the sort of mainstream legal academics, that's enough in their minds to go, oh, well, that means law sort of stands above these social conflicts. But then if you sort of say to them, obviously, you know, that's not realistic, right, for all these reasons, da-da-da-da-da, that's where their argument sort of starts to fail, is when you sort of force them to confront this fact that, oh, actually, you're just navel-gazing. You're talking about law as if it's this sort of abstract thing which could be anything, could have any content, you could do whatever you want with it. Actually, we know law is not a system. in the abstract, it's something that is used to control people, used to enforce the rules of the game. And no, actually, it couldn't be socialist just as easily as it could be capitalist. You know, the sort of practical unreality of that statement. The other point you mentioned, I see, Freddie, that you've got your hand up. I'll just round this off quickly. The other point you mentioned, very, very interesting, about trade unions resorting to, or workers resorting to, legal struggles rather than trade union struggles. Also, of course, trade unions themselves do a lot of litigation now in the British courts, in the European courts. I studied employment law as part of my undergrad degree. One thing I find very, very interesting about that is the sort of growth of workers' rights, like anti-discrimination protections and the law of unfair dismissal and the minimum wage and so on. A lot of these things came in very explicitly to stop workers from resorting to strikes. So in the 1960s, the government set up the Donovan Commission to try and reduce the number of strikes by bringing, and the recommendation they made was, you can reduce the number of strikes by having a law against unfair dismissal. And so in the 60s, 70s, it was sort of seen as this trade-off where employers sort of agreed to be subjected to some scrutiny through the courts, and in exchange it was felt that workers wouldn't need to go on strike so often, and we could have this sort of harmonious, more peaceful system of industrial relations. A lot of people said at the time it was nonsense, but you know, the government found that easier to sort of adopt that view than actually have to deal with social conflict in a meaningful way. And of course, it's impossible, I think, to understate just how much harder legally it is to go on strike in this country than it was in the 1970s as a result of the Thatcher era anti-union legislation. This is a personal view, but I would go so far as to say that striking is effectively tantamount to being illegal in this country. The hoops you have to jump through, the bureaucratic regulations you have to follow on balloting procedures and who has to be balloted and notice periods and so on and so forth, and the fact that a trade union can be sued for huge sums of money if they slip up on these rules has a really, really chilling effect on the right to strike. And I think that is a large part of why. I'll stop talking and go to Freddie now.
Thanks, Richard. I thoroughly enjoyed your address tonight, and very, very interesting. I'm sure other comrades found it the same. I could, up to a large extent, brought my hand down earlier on there, because you started to address this question of employment law and how the trade unions, etc., are increasingly, or have been increasingly for many years now, engaged in going through sort of litigation, going through the law process in times in preference to using a strike weapon, because as you rightly point out, the strike weapon is getting more and more and more and more shackled by the day. So really, yeah, because I mean, I don't know if I've told you before or not, but I mean, I was a full-time trade union official for about 8 years, 8-9 years, and quite avidly followed the employment tribunal cases, went to the London Law School, et cetera, doing employment law. I found it quite fascinating. But ultimately, for me, when I was looking at it, the laws that were being enacted were laws and their interpretation eventually boiled down to what you would virtually call judge-made laws, which is on balance
more favourable, substantially more favourable to the employing class than what it was to the working class. Yes, there's been a few successes, etc. And the one of the other points I was going to make was, but I can't remember when it was around about the mid-80s, if I recall correctly, where legislation was introduced, and it was statutory legislation, and it just didn't work at all. It just about seeking to avoid. I can't remember the actual act, but after a couple of years, it was just thrown out because nobody could understand it, and it virtually did make it illegal to strike. I'm just looking at you couldn't strike unless you went through, jumped through all sorts of hoops beforehand, and if you hadn't done that, then the action would have been unlawful in any event. So, you've addressed, or you actually raised yourself some of the points I was thinking of. But I thought your speech was very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. There is one point you raised there, though, about judge-made law. When I studied employment law, actually, that was a lot of why I sort of shook my naive faith in law and democracy, was because of my encounter with employment law judges. And now I think British judges have been fair and reasonable and just and wise in a great many situations. But for some reason, whenever it comes to employment law and dealing with employment law issues, we seem to have incredibly conservative-minded judges, in a way almost that they are not with any other issue. I think there's a real strange thing going on there. But I'll give you one specific example of this kind of judge-made law going completely against the workers and in favour of the employers, is the legislation which makes it unlawful to unfairly dismiss an employee, was brought in the 70s by Harold Wilson. And what the law actually says, I'm simplifying here, but what the law actually says is that in working out whether a decision to dismiss somebody was fair or not, the court has to consider whether the boss acted reasonably or unreasonably in making that decision. And for some reason, the courts have interpreted this to mean that a decision is to dismiss somebody as fair, provided it falls within a range of reasonable responses, considered subjectively from the perspective of the employer. And so this legislation which Parliament brought in to allow, or in fact to require courts to protect workers from being dismissed when it wouldn't be fair to do so, has sort of been defeated by judicial interpretation, because judges will treat basically any slapdash reason an employer can think of as a fair reason to dismiss, because, okay, it might not be perfect, but it falls within this broad range of responses which we think might have been reasonable based on the way they saw it at the time. And that is a perfect example. And also, again, going back to the main topic, is a perfect example of the material constitution and the ways in which, yes, we have laws, we have rights, but what does that matter if the people who are responsible for interpreting and enforcing those rights have a sort of intrinsic systematic bias against a certain worldview or a certain class of people? And I'll just finish up quickly with this quote from a senior judge, which I did put in my notes, but I didn't have time to mention in the end. It was from 1920. Senior Judge Lord Justice Scruton's told the University of Cambridge Law Society, he said, "The habits you're trained in, the people with whom you mix, lead to you having a certain class of ideas of such a nature that when you have to deal with other ideas, you do not give as sound and accurate judgments as you would wish. And he was explicitly talking about trade unions in that context and the working class. And it's sort of a, I think, rather sweet admission of his own innate biases. But that is not a problem that's gone away, and it never will be, so long as we live in a class-divided society. Adam?
Yeah, I can accept that very few people outside the legal academics can believe in autonomous law. But on the other hand, autonomous governments, I mean, that, lots of people believe in that. In fact, that is the whole basis of conventional politics. That people, all the political parties act on the assumption that if you elect them, they can pass legislation to solve these problems. And in fact, you know, your argument, it completely undermines the whole case for reformism because there are economic constraints. The governments can't do what they want to do. They can pass all sorts of laws, but they won't necessarily work. And because you mentioned trusts and mission, but you can say that every single reformist government in the end has come up against the economic laws of capitalism. And in fact, not only have they had to accept these, they've had to impose them themselves. I mean, so that this, what you call the material concept of law, or material, can apply that to governments, and it's our whole case against reformism.
You've hit the nail on the head, Adam, and actually that's a large part why I'm here and not still in the Labour Party, as it happens. So yeah, absolutely. And I think for socialists, that's why these ideas are so important, is because this sort of critique of capitalist freedom and capitalist democracy, and this sort of really hammering home this notion that actually political events are determined by material factors. I think that is one of the most important weapons we have as socialists to stop people from going down the failed paths of reformism. And, I'm 23 years old at the moment. I'll be 24 later this year. Frankly, when it comes to politics, the thing I'm most afraid of is that humanity will spend the next century repeating the mistakes we've made in the last century. I see a lot of people supporting, a lot of young people supporting, Green New Deal in America, these sorts of reformist projects, all the support and effort that went into Jeremy Corbyn, and he's not leader of the Labour Party anymore, but his ideas are still very popular. And nationalisation and reformism is that sort of drive to reformism. It's not perfect, but it's the best we can do, and this time it'll work. I think it's toxic to see that, to see those ideas having such influence amongst people who call themselves socialists. And so critiquing reformism, critiquing democracy, or at least capitalist democracy, I think that is one of the most important things we can do as socialists. Okay, well, if nobody has... Oh, sorry, John Cumming, I see you've got your hand up there.
Ah, yes, I just put up my hand this moment. This concept of autonomous subsystems, you might call them, within capitalism can, I think, actually be both advantageous and disadvantageous in some ways to the system, because the legal system, although almost nobody, apart from the rarefied people that you mentioned before, nobody really believes it. And even amongst them, I'm convinced some of them are just so arrogant that they just think they can hit the rest of us with a whole load of bullshit and we'll just accept it because these are clever, clever people. But I may be wrong about that. That may be just a prejudice of mine. But on the other hand, there was a judge somewhere in the south of England who when presented with people, protesters who had been arrested for going on to, I think, a nuclear site, he said, "Well, there's no grounds for to exclude them. They can go there if they like," and he released them, much to the annoyance of the police who were trying to do the government's bidding. I can't remember the full details about it, but you do get cases from time to time where judges just take the law, and it's part of this notion of autonomy, perhaps, that they originally had about the law. I would have thought that experience might have told them otherwise through time. But nonetheless, for whatever reasons, these judges have decided, well, no, the law says this. And despite the fact that the government would like me to go along with them, I'm going to, even if I don't really believe in this separation of powers, I'm going to apply it here because that is what it says. On the other hand, you'll get, as was mentioned earlier, judges who will interpret things from the class point of view. And even although some of them might not be capitalists themselves, they come from a background in which most of the people they know identify with capitalist class interests. And one of the reasons why these so-called top people get so much money is to make sure that, it's peanuts to the capitalist class. And you can imagine the monarch saying, well, you do so much for one, for surprisingly little. And they get a taste of the good life and they're willing to do the capitalist dirty work. But as I say, on the other hand, you've got others who like that judge, was releasing people against the wishes of the state. And of course, the state's in an awkward position because it doesn't want to show just how awful the system really is. It wants to. It's for similar reasons that the government felt compelled to obey what the electorate had said in the Brexit referendum. They talk all this talk about democracy, and then when the people decide, based on, being fed a bunch of lies from both sides, but anyway, the people decided. This is something that convinces me that socialism wouldn't be anywhere near as difficult as a lot of left-wing people say when the workers vote in favour of it, because they were scared on a trivial thing like Brexit to go against what the backward working class had voted for. They thought, no, we can't keep the veneer of pretending that there's democracy. So that gives a bit of hope. But the other thing I was going to say about one other subsystem is the NHS, the so-called National Health Service. Now, it would suit the capitalist class if it were much more geared towards what it originally was intended to be, which was a patch you up and get you back to work service. Unfortunately, a lot of people who work for it, from the capitalist point of view, have taken it much more seriously that, no, we want to do more than just patch people up and get them back to work. We want a healthy population, if we can at all achieve that. So to a certain extent, as well as the legal, the heights of the legal profession, having spun off into a little world of its own, you also get that in other subsystems within society. And you could say that within the health service, these people, most of whom, most people who work for it would like to actually make people healthier and try and treat them without regard to, the interests of the wider system. Now, because of the capitalists having control of the purse strings, of course, that determines how hard or easy, usually hard, how hard it is to achieve that. And these are sort of tensions that are created within society. And I could go on about other subsystems that we might call them, where people are beavering away, trying to do the best they can for people, not realising that because of the capitalist control of society, all their efforts are thwarted at every turn. But I'll stop there. One thing I thought I heard you saying towards the beginning of your talk I thought you had mentioned somebody who said that a constitution should be almost the exact opposite of reality. I take it that was some tyrant. I missed that part, if I got it right. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for that. Just give me one second. I'll see if I can find the quote. The quote was, it makes no difference what is written on a piece of paper so long as it contradicts the real state of things. And that was from Ferdinand LaSalle, who was, he was actually a socialist and a contemporary of Marx. I think he meant it as an observation. He wasn't endorsing tyranny. I think he was just observing that that's how things work in society. And certainly if you lived in Prussia in the 1860s under an absolute monarchy, that was definitely how it worked. Liam, I see you've got your hand up. I will come to you and then I'll respond to both at the same time.
Hi. Just a brief observation because it's obviously listening to some of the other contributions.
Darren, can you get nearer the microphone? You're really muffled.
Is that, I might just be, I'm suffering from COVID. So maybe
no, it's the microphone. It's really muffled.
I tell you what, I won't make my contribution. If people can't hear me, then that's it. No worries.
If it's easier, you're welcome to try typing the question. There should be a little chat box on the right-hand side. While you do that, I'll respond to some of the previous comment about subsystems. Yes, and there's that judge who in the south east, I think it was, he said, yeah, there are cases like that. I mean, all individuals in society act as individuals. I think what we have to remember is sort of the clashing of social forces of different classes is something that goes on unconsciously for most people. We're not really aware of these conflicts. We participate in them, take sides in them without even knowing it. And Marx was very, you know, he laid out this view in his writings that when it comes to society, we have instincts and then we act on those instincts first. And then our ideas change to reflect the world around us. But you start with the instincts and the actions before you get the ideas. There's evidence the class conflict all around us. Every time a worker goes on strike, every time there's a case of police brutality, every time a huge corporation squirrels its money away to avoid paying taxes or moves jobs overseas. These are all examples of the class conflict. But of course, the vast, vast majority of people don't experience it in that way. It's a question of whether most people ever will, as Marx observes in the German ideology, as I say. The ruling ideology is the ideology of the ruling class. And the process of sort of the transformation of society that Marx describes sort of happens almost unconsciously. But that's a whole other question, a whole separate kettle of fish to open. Specifically to talk about subsystems, yeah, people all go about their business trying to do the best they can. Nobody thinks themselves as being unjust or unfair, but we see the world from different perspectives. And, you know, what fairness means to a billionaire will be different to what it means to you and me. And that is sort of the basis for the sort of materialist analysis of society laid out by Marx, is that observation. Whether the existence of these subsystems and the extent to which they may or may not be autonomous is advantageous to socialists, very interesting point. I don't have enough, or I need to look more into the case you're talking about to express a well-informed opinion on it. But also at the same time, we have to remember for every good judge, for every good police officer, there'll also be bad ones. And so it's kind of swings and roundabouts. But really, the crucial point, I think, for socialists isn't to think in terms of good or bad people, but to look at what does the system ask of us. So judges, yes, are completely independent from the government, from the party of the day, whichever one happens to be in power. You look at things like the enemies of the people case and stuff like that, where judges were denounced as enemies of the people for making a ruling against the government. And this kind of thing happens fairly frequently in this country. And so judges are independent from the state, but they can't be independent from the economic system, which sort of stands in the background of everything, the real relations of society. So the judges are part of the constitution and they are an independent part of that constitution, but that independence will only get you so far. Because at the end of the day, the rules they have to enforce are still the rules of a capitalist society. Joel Thompson, I believe, has a hand up there.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Thanks for the talk. very informative. This is something somebody sent me, and it's about the government's, they want a third reading of a bill this Wednesday. And it regards the anti-boycott bill, which should progress towards law. I'm just trying to find it. Sorry about this.
No worries.
Yeah, the anti-boycott bill will prevent public bodies, including local councils, universities, and public sector pension funds, from making ethical choice about spending and investment, and ban their participation in political boycotts like those that helped to end apartheid. Are you aware of this?
So I have sort of seen the bill going through Parliament. Of course, it's not desirable for any of us here, I think, to restrict people's freedom of association in that way. Mm. It's very obviously a repressive measure. What we do about that as socialists, I'm not sure. But I do think if I can connect that to a sort of wider point, is as socialists, we have to be constantly thinking about the ways in which the law cracks down on our activities. You can look at all these measures which have been taken against protests, peaceful protests recently, and the recent legislation against strikes. And I don't know if people have been following it, but the recent information that's come out about police surveillance by special branch of environmental activists, and there is always these things going on. And that certainly isn't anything new, in the time Marx was writing. All of these sort of socialist points of view and activities would have landed you in jail, if not worse. Whether it's BDS, I'm not familiar with all the details of the law, but yes, I am aware the government's trying to outlaw the boycott of Israel by pension funds and things. But whether it's BDS or measures on freedom of protest or other measures, I think we have to be constantly vigilant against that, because if we can't express ourselves, then we can't build a movement. You cannot build a movement. Well, you can try to build a movement underground, but it's certainly a lot easier to do it when you have the freedom to speak, freedom to think, the freedom to write. And just to sort of tie up this point is, I think the sort of liberal freedoms that we've won in the past 150 years after the French Revolution, well, 200 years after the French Revolution, are not completely worthless. Living in a society that has formal freedom, as Britain does, is better than living in an absolutist dictatorship, because it makes it easier for us to express our beliefs, to build up our movement. And I think as socialists, we have to defend the legal right to express our point of view. And we have to oppose most vigorously any laws which seek to make it unlawful for us to carry out our activities. And so, yeah, I I'm sorry again, I don't know the specifics of the law, but I hope that is sort of relevant or to what you're saying.
No, thank you. Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
Liam has typed a question in the chat. I will read that out and then I'll go to John. And after that, I'll probably wrap up because I have to head on shortly. But Liam says, probably a frivolous point, but I was just wondering about the politicization of law in recent years, where it looks like it's become part and parcel of the culture wars. I'm thinking especially of what's going on in the States, where the law is becoming increasingly party political. In its own way, it's as problematic as people thinking that law is above society, where now increasing amounts of people are of the opinion that the law and its enforcement is dictated by dark money or polarizing figures such as George Soros or the Koch Foundation. People are wrapping themselves in the comfort of conspiracy theories as opposed to what we are arguing for, a class analysis of law and the state, etc. Yeah, that's a very good point. And I suppose it ties in with sort of the wider point about conspiracy theories and how socialists should deal with conspiracy theories. I think the best way to deal with it is to, rightly, as you point out, stick to a class analysis and an analysis of the material relations and the structure of capitalism. Capitalism works the way it does not because it's being controlled by billionaires. It works the way it does because when you have an economic system based on the accumulation of capital, as we do, it leads in certain directions. I mean, you know, you'd have to go and read Das Kapital to get the full argument. I really am not an expert on this. But once you have a system based on capital accumulation, certain consequences flow from that. The class system, the division of labor, inequality of wealth, the state and its violence against ordinary people, all these things are products of living in this system where profitability and the money system are at the heart of it. And the best way to fight conspiracy theorists in that sense is to try and show to them this class analysis of society and say, you're barking up the wrong tree. You're getting sort of tied in knots trying to work out which Jews are controlling the world whilst you're ignoring the very real systematic factors that are actually the reason why our society is bad. Very, very important point. We must not fall prey to conspiracy theories. And certainly the politicization of law or conspiracy theories about law have been a part of that debate, unfortunately. John, I will give you the last question.
Oh, well, it wasn't really a question as such. I just wanted to make the remark that the capitalists are quite happy for you to have certain so-called rights as long as you don't really exercise them. This was a thing I noticed as a child, that none of the newspapers, none of them, ever said any strike that was current was acceptable. Of course you must have the right of strike, they would say, but this is not the time, for various reasons, which were just, even as a child, I could see was quite ridiculous. But it did take me, I felt, an inordinate amount of time to realise, once I became maybe a teenager or something, gradually I realised, oh, of course, the reason why they have that point of view is that the same people who own the factories and the workplaces are the same people who own the papers and own the media. You know, and I thought I should have realised that. But of course, there's lots of things in hindsight you think, why did I not realise that? And I think when we do have a majority for socialism, it will be a bit like that. I think Engels at one time wrote something to the effect that socialism won't really come about until it becomes almost like similar to people have a prejudice about the society they're in. This is how society should work. Just like you were saying about a society based on accumulation, everyone in it is brought up with the idea that's what you have to do. And of course, any capitalist who tried not to do that, well, he might soon find that he's no longer a member of the capitalist class, which is undesirable, because many of them, on making that discovery that they were going to have to end up like us, threw themselves out of tall buildings in 1929 and the aftermath. So on the one hand, there's hope, but on the other, it's a long, hard slog. And understanding things about capitalism, as I say, it's difficult to put yourself back where you didn't know what you now know. And, well, that's just one of those things. Thanks.
Yeah. You're absolutely correct. I mean, freedoms are so these legal freedoms and rights we have are respected the most when they are needed the least. But there are countless examples of capitalist state riding roughshod over its own laws. Or even its own constitutional principles to stop, in particular, left-wing activists. For example, the FBI spying on communists in the 50s, the assassination of leaders of the Black Panthers in the 60s, 70s in America by the CIA, or the first Red Scare in 1920, the Palmer Raids, when radical trade unionists in America were deported back to Europe, had their houses searched and were arrested completely unlawfully with no judicial oversight because they were suspected anarchist, socialist, communist, whatever. In Germany, after the Second World War, the Communist Party was banned there. In South Africa in the 1950s, the Communist Party was banned. In the 1950s in Japan, the American occupation government committed a purge of left-wing civil servants. So countless examples of this sort of violations of due process against left-wing voices. And the capitalist class will fight tooth and nail to hold on to its power. I think in Britain, we tend to have this very complacent notion of rights and democracy because our system has been so stable for so long. But if ever there was a real radical socialist movement in this country, we have to be very, very clear on this. The capitalist class would fight tooth and nail against it, through means both fair and foul. And so as part of being a socialist means accepting that and hopefully knowing how to deal with it if and when it arises. But you can look at, and I think the best example of this is Nazi Germany, where a large part of how the Nazis got into power was exploiting anti-communist sentiment amongst landowners and industrialists and petty proprietors and reactionaries generally. The Communist Party of Germany supported the Soviet model, and so in that sense, you know, we wouldn't necessarily recognise them as our kindred spirits. But nonetheless, the German working class, for the most part, supported some kind of socialist or socialist adjacent idea. You had the Communist Party of Germany and the Social Democratic Party of Germany combined were more popular than the Nazis were. And the response to this increased radicalism of the German working class in the 20s and 30s was political violence and a fascist dictatorship. And the very first thing the Nazis did when they got into power was round up the communist leaders and put them into camps. Before anything else, they raided the trade union offices and smashed them up, shut down the socialist newspapers. It was fundamentally a time when big industrialists and big landowners funded the Nazi Party and supported them into power for the purpose of destroying the working class movement. And so there are countless examples of this happening, and we need to sit down and have a long and hard think about how to respond to these sort of events, because they do happen and we do have to be aware of them. And on that note, I will wrap it up. I'll just very briefly say there's been one other comment in the chat. Matthew S. says, the US president has today bombed Yemen, even though the US Constitution states he should have consulted Congress. Christ. Well, I'm not surprised. On that note, I will wrap it up. We've been here now, I think, an hour and a half, I think. Thank you all, everybody, for coming. I've been delighted to have this opportunity to present these ideas for you, and I've thoroughly enjoyed the quality of the questions and hopefully giving a semi-comprehensible response to them. So thank you very much, all, and thanks for coming.
Thank you very much, Uta, for the talk and also for chairing your own meeting. Really excellent. Look forward to you doing it again soon.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Before you go, next week it's John Cumming, I believe, is discussing whether the internet has enhanced or inhibited workers' understanding of the world. So that'll be next Friday evening, same time. Okay, so we'll look forward to seeing you all back again then.